Tracy? Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful, beautiful Wednesday. I'm very happy to be here with you. And my guest today is Roberto Romano, and I'll be introducing him in a little while. He's an award-winning producer and director and filmmaker, and I'm really excited to have him here talking about his latest work, The Harvest. And just want to talk to you about what's going on in my garden. I was out there all day today in the rain, pruning my pear tree and cutting all the weeds back from my blueberry bushes and covering them with some netting to keep the birds away. But they're filled with blueberries and they're not ripe yet, but I know the birds were just waiting soon. They were going to descend upon my blueberry bushes, so I got the netting up just in time. And we put the cages around my tomato plants, and so it's all really happening. I still have more to get in. I have some eggplants that I want to put into the ground and some fennel. So that's exciting, and I have two wonderful interns working with me who are so helpful. And then we came back in, dried off a little, and made some cookies for tonight, because tonight we're having a screening of the movie The Harvest. And so directly from the studio, Roberta and I will be driving out to the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington. And at 7:30 tonight is the screening of The Harvest. And if any of you are available, please try to come down. It's going to be a great event. We will have a question and answer with the producer and filmmaker himself, and it should be really great. So I hope to see many of you there. Tomorrow night is a community garden and environmental program fundraiser at the Old Bethpage Village Restoration in the renovated barn that they refurbished, and it's a beautiful barn. And it's an art show and fundraiser. And so there's going to be some great artwork there. There's going to be some hors d'oeuvres. And I believe it's $25 to get in. If you're interested, it's being organized by the Soil and Water Conservation of Nassau County. So the email there is artforsoilandwater@gmail.com, and you can find out some more information to and buy tickets for that. And then on Saturday, Gary Null himself will be at the Cinema Arts Center in the afternoon, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, screening his new movie War on Health, FDA's Power of Tyranny, and so that should be a really great event as well. There's also the first Brooklyn Permaculture Meetup coming up on June 18th. And starting next week, June 23rd, Edible New York is having their Edible Eat Drink Local Week. So lots of restaurants are participating. You can look that up online and take advantage of that. All the local restaurants that are, or the restaurants that support local produce, they will be participating. So check that out. There's a couple things that I'd like to bring your awareness to. There is, as many of you know, the GMOs are going up for a ballot in California this November. And so there's petitions going on all around the internet. And if you haven't already, you should sign on and support labeling of GMOs, that's genetically modified organisms. And we all have a right to know what is in our food. And it is, for some reason, being kept from us. And 90%, in a recent poll, 90% of all Americans want to know what foods are genetically modified and want to know what's in the ingredients in their food. And it's being kept from us. So please, when you see a petition come across your email, please sign on and participate. Also, the Food and Farm Bill is coming up, and you'll also see lots of emails about that. as well as fracking. These are all really, really important issues that are really in the forefront right now, and we need to show our support for them. The anti-fracking movement is really gaining momentum, and I actually was looking at something this morning that actually got mailed to me about the drilling and the gas lines that they're trying to drill for in Alaska, and not the Keystone Pipeline. The Keystone Pipeline is a whole nother. Yes, Marcellus Shale. And there's so many different issues that are in the forefront right now that are threatening our natural resources and our environment, and we all need to become aware of them and sign on and show support both monetarily and by calling our senators and congressmen. So I hope many of you will participate and do that. So also, I cook weekly for clients, and one of my clients is really trying to eat more more raw these days. And so I've been making blended salad for her, which I know it doesn't sound so great, blended salad, but I got to tell you, I've been enjoying it along with her, and it is just so great. And all you do is in a food processor, basically a whole head of romaine lettuce, a couple stalks of celery, some carrots, some cucumber. I put a lot of parsley in, maybe some kale. Ginger is always great. And blend it up. And it's like a bowl of delicious goodness. And you can feel the vitamins and the minerals going into your body with every bite. And so I really recommend, in the summer, it's just a great food to have. And it's a way that you can get a lot of raw vegetables into your body. And it's just great. So, and of course, I squeeze a lot of lemon in there as well. Lemon and a little bit of salt. Salt might not be what everybody else wants, but it definitely brings out some of the flavor for me. So just a little bit of salt and lemon, and it's just great. So I've been doing a lot of that, but I came up with a raw lemon lime pie for her, because dessert is always a challenge, and this dessert was great. So I'm going to share this recipe with you. And it's so easy. My God, it's so easy. So the crust, I just wiped the bottom of a pie pan with a little bit of coconut oil first, just so the crust wouldn't stick. I ground I ground almonds in a food processor, and I measured out a cup of ground raw almonds, 1 cup of shredded coconut, 6 organic dates, 1 teaspoon of vanilla, 2 tablespoons of raw agave, and just a pinch of salt, and pureed that together until it all comes together and sticks together, and then I pressed it into the pie pan. And one thing I did that I was looking on the internet, looking at a lot of raw food desserts, and for some reason, usually they just put the crust in and they don't decorate the crust. And usually when you buy a pie, the pie crust is always fluted. And there was no reason you can't flute the edge of this. So I pressed the pie crust all the way up the edge of the pie pan. And then when I got to the top, between my index finger and my thumb, I just pinched the crust together and fluted the edge, and it made it look much prettier. Then for the filling, I did 1/2 avocado to give it a little green, 6 tablespoons agave, 1/2 cup of coconut oil, 1.5 cups of cashews. Now, the cashews I soaked in water for about 3 hours. I know some recipes call for you soaking overnight, and some say you don't have to soak at all. I soaked them for about 3 hours and then pureed them. 2 teaspoons of lemon zest, 2 teaspoons of lime zest, 3 tablespoons of fresh lemon juice, 3 tablespoons of fresh lime juice, and pureed that together. And it was great, really delicious. And if you didn't want to do the crust, you could just put those right into parfait cups and serve them like that as well. It'd be really, really delicious and very refreshing. And or you can serve it as, put it in the freezer and serve it as raw ice cream, and it would be great as well. So anyways, I poured the filling into the pie crust. And just to decorate the top, I decided I would puree some raspberries. So I pureed some raspberries and put that on top and decorated the edge with raspberries. And it was just beautiful. beautiful, and I was told it was tasted delicious. Of course, I couldn't cut a piece out of the pie before giving it to my client, so I didn't get to taste it, but I tasted each of the parts separately, and they were all great. So give it a try. And let me know how it is. You can send me an email at bhavani@ieatgreen.com. And I'm here at the Progressive Radio Network studio with my guest, Roberto Romano. And Roberto, known as Robin to many of his friends, is an award-winning human rights educator, filmmaker, and photographer. And Roberto began his activism on the issue of child labor going back in 1995 when he was in Pakistan to film a story of the murder of, how do you say the name?
Iqbal Masih.
Iqbal Masih, a child carpet slave who turned activist. And since then, Robin has been traveling extensively and documenting the manifestations of child labor that invisibly penetrate the lives of countless Americans. And I was fascinated to find out about his work. The first time I met Robin was when we screened the movie The Dark Side of Chocolate, which was an eye-opening movie in itself. I had never really thought much about where my chocolate came from prior to seeing this movie. And now, I tell you, it's a real challenge trying to find fair trade chocolate wherever I go. You know, even the really fine chocolate companies, you know, I've called them and I've spoken to them, and they have some programs that are fair trade, little parts of their production. But they've told me that they can't produce enough chocolate if all in fair trade, which I don't think is really true. It's just, you know, it's their transition over to it. But at least they're becoming aware of it, the higher end companies. And then there's, of course, the Nestle's and the Hershey's that are still, you know, want to keep a closed door to the whole issue. So be aware of where your chocolate comes from. But anyway, that's when I first met Robin. And through that movie, he showed a lot of the abuses that were being manifested upon children because so many of the cocoa beans were being processed by children or picked, harvested by children. So now his latest movie called The Harvest, and I know he's working on another one too that he'll tell us about, but The Harvest is an incredible movie really highlighting the child labor issues right here in this country. And so it's my pleasure to invite Robin in. He's right here in the studio with me. Hello, Robin.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us.
That's great to be here.
So I know you've been documenting child labor around the world, but I would have thought in this country there's laws to protect children. So tell us, what's going on?
Well, that is the most stunning irony, which is that, you know, having traveled the world, documenting the worst forms of child labor, I have to sit closer to the mic.
Yeah.
Is that better?
All right. Yes.
Here we are in Radio Land. So after having traveled the world documenting the worst forms of child labor, you turn around and you find out that it exists here in this country and that it is legal. And that was what was most stunning to me and to most people. And after having done Dark Side of Chocolate, Stolen Childhoods, and a series of other films that deal with child labor around the world, I thought, well, in the words of Shakespeare, physician, heal thyself. I think we needed to take a very sort of unemotional and very, very sort of cold and legal eye to what's going on our own fields. I mean, it's very hypocritical that we will point the finger at countries like Uzbekistan or India or other places and say,
China.
Yeah, wherever, mm-hmm. You know, precisely. And we'll say to them, you know, how dare you have children work unlimited hours in 100-degree heat, you know, bending over in the hot sun, you know, picking cotton or everything else. And this was at the core of a speech that Senator Harkin gave, you know, on World Day Against Child Labor a couple of years ago, I believe it was in 2010. He got up in front of the Senate right after World Day Against Child Labor, which was yesterday, for those of you out there in the studio audience. And he described these abuses, and I recognized those abuses, and I had documented children, some as young as 9, performing those tasks here in the United States. And so I figured maybe it was time for us to take a look at ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's so important. It's so easy all the time to point a finger somewhere else. I know I've heard people complaining about, businessmen in China, and you can't trust them, and they'll just, tell you one thing and then do something else, and that, they are, putting bad things into all kinds of food products, et cetera, et cetera. And I've looked at people and go, what about beech nut right here in our country? I remember when I first gave birth to my daughter, who's now 32, it had just come out that beech nut was selling artificially colored sugar water as apple juice in baby bottles. And so I think when people are dealing with power and money, abuse happens. It shouldn't, but I think it does. And I don't think it's only abroad. It's right here in our country, and yeah. It's really scary.
Well, we now have entered the realm of that it's no longer one person, one vote. I think, after Citizens United, we now live in a country where it's $1, one vote. So I'm not sure how many of these problems that we're discussing or others, really will be solved in the near future.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's stay hopeful.
Okay.
Let's stay hopeful and try to get as many of the listeners that are listening involved so that they can do their part. Because that's one of the things that I really try to promote is not giving up. And that there are so many problems. And if everybody picks one and does something in their own little sphere, that's better than everybody just complaining and not doing anything.
Well, right. I mean, when you say $1, one vote, that still doesn't mean that we can't, as citizens, just not only as people who are allowed to vote in this country, but as consumers, we have clout in the global marketplace by making smart choices, by making moral choices, and by making ethical choices about what it is that we choose to put on our plate. So I always encourage everybody to be both a citizen and a consumer.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you have to operate in as many cylinders as you can so that we have policies that are healthy and humane in this country and elsewhere.
And I think the most important thing is for people to start knowing what some of these issues are, because people don't even know. I watched a trailer about the food workers and, the abuses that people are dealing with unfair practices in restaurants. And, a lot of the restaurants are sustainable restaurants,
right.
Where the food is good and the food is local and the food is, all the things that you would think make it a restaurant that you want to go to. And then you find out that, workers are being underpaid, they're being asked to work overtime or being told they have to work overtime and not being paid for it. And there's a lot of abuses that happen there, too. So the more we all can become educated about what all the issues are, the more we can take a stance on it. So what role does the International Labor Organization have in protecting children from working in unfair and dangerous situations?
Well, the International Labor Organization, which we'll call the ILO for the sake of time from here on out, has literally put forward 8 core conventions, of which at least 2 of them deal specifically with child labor and the worst forms of child labor. And I have to say that as an American, of the 8 core conventions, we're only operating on 2 of them, and only 1 of the 2 that deal with child labor. So we've ratified and signed on to a law called ILO Convention Number 182, otherwise known as IPEC, the Convention of the Worst Forms of Child Labor. And essentially what this does is that, the countries that sign on to it say, yes, we are going to work against the worst forms of child labor in our country. And yet, by the ILO's last reckoning, 215 million children, that's almost 250 million kids around the world, are still working in the worst forms of child labor. And over 60% of them are in agriculture, which is really where the heart of the matter is at this point, both abroad and here. So the ILO literally tries to set international conventions and get
everybody to sign onto them. So international conventions, is that like a treaty or like a...
It's a promise, in a way. It's a promise that when you sign, let's say, ILO 182, you ratify it, you sign it, and then you're supposed to be able to create laws in your own country afterwards that deal with this problem. Unfortunately, when Bill Clinton signed ILO 182, the Convention Against the Worst Forms of Child Labor, in December of 2000, He signed it with a signing statement saying that we were already in compliance, even though at that point, 500,000 children worked in violation of that law.
In this country?
In this country, yes.
Wow. And do you think he knew that?
I would say that it's kind of hard to miss. You know, I think there's, you know, there's been a lot of noise. During that time, there were a lot of advocates and there were a lot of researchers and organizations, among them Human Rights Watch, which published in, you know, that same year, Fingers to the Bone, which was a blistering, blistering indictment of the agricultural sector and child labor in this country. But I think, you know, that we've seen, again, recently, that any changes to these rules and regulation are very, very hard to come by. Essentially, there's a loophole in the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938, and that was, you know, part of that great democratic revolution that, you know, that, that brought us the 40-hour work week, the right to collective bargaining, you know, the right to overtime, the right to a day off. And agriculture was excluded. And even back then, and even before, as we were moving towards these more enlightened labor policies, people were pushing back under the sort of rubric of the family farm.
That's what I was going to ask you about. You know, kids doing chores around the farm. You always hear about that.
Right. But, you know, that's a red herring in a way, which is that what really happened is you need to look at, you need to look at the population of pickers in this country historically. You know, and when you go back, and even when you look at Edward R. Murrow's Harvest of Shame, arguably the greatest television documentary ever made, you know, the majority of the people picking are people who we would normally associate with racial and class exclusion. And I think that those are actually the real reasons. Also, in America, we've been used to cheap food for so long. We pay the least amount of our discretionary income on food of any of the developed countries, almost by half. It's 10% in this country. The next lowest that you'll find is in the UK at 17%, and then everybody else is above 20%. So by half, we spend less, and I think we've gotten used to it. We also have very, very distorted agricultural policies in this country, and I'm sure you'll be talking about that over the next few weeks. It's, you'll see it in the Farm Bill with direct and indirect subsidies. And there's kind of a joke, which is that we've gone from the grapes of wrath to the grapes of graft. So I think when you step back and you imagine a moral universe, there's absolutely no excuse for this type of behavior to go on anywhere, especially in this country.
Right. Did the CARE bill, the Children's Act for Responsible Employment, ever get passed? And what was the CARE bill?
Well, the CARE bill is a bill that would have plugged those loopholes in the Fair Labor Standards Act and protected children in agriculture in this country who really do need protection. Every year the reports come out and it points to the fact that agriculture is the most lethal profession for children. You know, and when you look at the numbers, especially on migrant children, you see that they drop out at four times the rate. They're continually falling behind. All of the indicators are way in the negative for them. They are a group that is unfairly impacted by the lack of regulation for them. And, you know, it started with Senator Harkin and now Lucy Roy Ballard, the wonderful congresswoman out of California, you know, has been trying to reintroduce this bill every year. And when we released the Congress, I mean, when we released The Harvest, Eva Longoria, my executive producer, Susan McClory, Albie Heck, Julia Perez, my associate producer, and I, we all went down to D.C. to have a press conference to when Representative Roy Ballard was going to reintroduce the bill. And there was a lot of fanfare. And yet, you know, I always feel that many of these moral legislations fall on deaf ears these days. We tend to be in a kind of ethical gridlock right now in our own government and in our own Congress, and it's very distressing. So the CARE bill, like these children, sort of continues to languish. You know, it's almost an out-of-sight, out-of-mind mentality.
And I think in so many issues, when you have an unfranchised group who don't have a lot of their own rights and they're not from here, they're not organized, and they're, you know, they're disenfranchised and they're just not represented. And
It's true. I remember Bob Dole once said, you know, poor people don't contribute. You know, and that was when we talk about the unfranchised or the disenfranchised, as I refer to them, mm-hmm. and everything else. Also, they're a very highly mobile population. This is a group that literally chases harvests around the country. So it's also, in many ways, it's very difficult to develop a geographic constituency. They literally do exist in a kind of a floating world.
Oh, really? So they move around,
yeah.
more like...
Right. Well, when you look at the harvest, you'll see that we have children coming out of Florida and Texas. And, you know, many of them travel and work through 3, 4, 5, as many as 12 states. I mean, they'll just keep chasing whatever crop they can chase to make a living. You know, we tend to forget, and this is what you were talking about earlier, which is that the disconnect, that even when you go into... a high-end restaurant that's touting its sustainability and it's that, you know, it's for locavores and that, you know, we're eating in our own bioregion and everything else. The 800-pound gorilla in the agricultural room is labor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the point of fact is the average salary for a migrant family of four is like $17,500. So that puts them well below the poverty line. And as a result, I mean, they're forced to chase whatever they can, where it grows, when it grows. And, you know, I've traveled with families where they'll finish picking at 4 o'clock one afternoon. It's the end of the field. They're going to turn that field over. And they get in the car and they'll drive 5, 6, 700 miles to the next destination where they know there's going to be work. And sometimes even that doesn't happen. You know, we forget and how much weather has a hand and how unpredictable. I think, well, we're becoming more aware of how unpredictable weather is becoming. I mean, we've mm-hmm. had two of the last or three of the last 5 years have been like FEMA record holders. You know, so obviously something else is afoot as well. But, you know, it's not something that operates like clockwork. It's not where you punch in at 9 o'clock at, you know, in a factory and then leave at 5. It's sort of like, well, did Ohio get, you know, an average of 3 inches of rain? Did they have, you know, 20 days of sunshine? You know,
is the harvest ready?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. You know, what are the indicators in the soil? Also, you know, did the farmer put in enough potash or fertilizer? You know, it's a life in which the only thing certain is uncertainty. Mm-hmm. You know, so this is the type of hard scrabble existence that they lead on the road.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could be back in the era of Steinbeck, you know, when you travel with migrants today. Very little has changed. I mean, we've had certain rules and legislations that have come and gone, you know, most notably with, you know, the United Farm Workers for a while and everything else. But invariably, most of these are overturned. It's always a constant struggle to organize for dignity. And I mean, and right now we have, you know, Lucas Benitez, you know, and Geraldo Reyes with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers who've gotten that wonderful penny mm-hmm. a pound increase mm-hmm. for tomatoes. Now, to most Americans, a penny a pound may not sound like much. It isn't, you know, but it literally, it ostensibly doubles the wage that tomato pickers in Florida are getting. So that's, you know, an extraordinary thing. But yes, you know, the labor component here is something that really needs looking at. And it's not just the child labor. It's the labor itself. I mean, mm-hmm. children work because their parents don't make enough money. You know, children work because of poverty. Poverty is the push factor mm-hmm. that puts children into the fields.
Right. And so is it mostly their parents that are encouraging them to work to help support the family?
Yes, and it's also these children. Most of the children I spoke to had this extraordinary sense of responsibility to their family right. as well.
Right.
You know, but the point of fact is that, you know, you're arguing a point that I don't think in America today or in the world of today that we should even, you know, think about. It's mind-boggling to me that, you know, someone can ask a question, well, you know, these kids have to work because, you know, we'd have to pay more for food. You know, I mean, and in some ways it goes back to the earlier model of slavery. It's sort of like, well, would you condone slavery because you could eat cheaper? You know, there have to be certain moral and ethical limits below which we won't go if we want
Absolutely.
To call ourselves civilized.
Absolutely. I agree. So let's take a couple minute break, and when we come back, we'll talk more about what other projects you're working on now as well.
Okay.
All right?
Yeah.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm here in the studio with Roberto Romano, the award-winning producer and director of the movie The Harvest, which we're screening this evening at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington at 7:30. And following that, we'll have a question and answer with Roberto in the studio or in the theater. And I hope many of you can join us. And right now, we're just talking about the unfair labor laws in regards to children and even for adults working in agriculture in this country and around the world. And, you know, I've just been shocked at learning about the abuses that are going on right here in this country. So anyway, Roberta's right here with us. And so, Roberta, can you tell me, are there any protections that are in place to protect children in hazardous conditions, or they don't exist?
Well, they don't exist. But recently, and this was a terrible loss for the community, Hilda Solis and the Department of Labor had put forth what we call new hazardous orders. They were safety regulations. They were very mild. They had been recommended by NIOSH, National Institute of Science and Health, 10 years ago, and they would have represented the first safety regulation improvements regarding children in agriculture in 40 years in this country. And on April 26th, the Obama administration did an about-face and literally said that they would not follow these through for the duration of the administration, which, if he wins re-election, means that we have another non-compliance with ILO IPEC, because the Convention Against the Worst Forms of Child Labor that everybody signed has in it a roadmap to end child labor by 2016. So if we're not going to do anything to increase the safety standards for children in the fields and the work remains hazardous, we are now even more blatantly in violation of this law than we were before. And what was really, really stunning and where you saw the power of the was that over 180 members of our Senate and House literally got behind a bill called the Save the Family Farm Act of 2012. And we're always running up against this idea of the family farm. And you try to sell it, or they try to sell it to Americans as this sort of bucolic field where Opie comes out, you know, this sort of blonde, blonde-haired kid
with freckles, right?
You know, with a bucket. He walks through a field of clover, you know, gently milks Bessie and then comes back with the morning's milk. Well, that's hardly the reality. You know, the reality is people like Zulema Lopez, you know, who started picking onions when she was like 8 or 9 years old, you know, and they're roused. And you'll see this is one of the opening scenes in The Harvest is of her being roused from bed by her mother at like 3:45 in the morning before school begins, because that's the life of these children, which is that they work before school and they work after school. I remember Jessica Rios, who was another migrant farm worker who I interviewed, didn't make it into the film, but I pre-interviewed close to 50 children for this movie, and listening to her schedule exhausted me. Again, it's one of those 3:30 in the morning, I'm up, I'm helping my mother make lunch for the field, we're getting the family ready, we're putting the buckets out and everything else. Then we go to the field, then I go to school, then I get out of school, and then I go into the fields with my parents at around 4 or 5. We work till the sun goes down, which during the summer is very late. You know, and then they sort of come home, and then she had to do her homework. So all of a sudden, here is a child who is literally working 16 to 18 hours a day, going to school. I mean, she was sleeping 4 hours a night at most during one of the most formative times, you know, in her development. Jessica Rios ends up being the exception. She now When I first met her, she wanted to be a registered nurse. Now she's at the Renaissance Center in Texas on a full scholarship, and she's actually now thinking that she may even want to become a doctor. You know, and so she's beginning her science courses in college and everything else. But that's the exception. These children...
I thought, actually, most of these kids even dropped out of school. Isn't there a huge dropout? Four times?
Yeah, it's four times the national average, you know, which is stunning. So, and that is, you know, basically part of it is just schedule. If you follow the harvests, you know, it means you need to leave before school's out. And if you keep working for as long as you can keep working, because as we all know, these jobs really aren't paid at minimum wage. As a matter of fact, the law specifically says you don't have to make minimum wage. So they will leave April, you know, and they'll return as late as November to school. So they're always, always falling behind. They're leaving early, coming back late. And as a result, you know, their education is incomplete and inchoate.
Uh-huh. So unfair. You just feel like they're stuck and there's no one to represent them.
Yeah. It's the best example we have of forcing a group of people, a cohort, into a cycle of poverty.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's as if, you know, our agricultural policy has firmly placed our thumb on the back of their necks.
Uh-huh. Well, I want to thank you, you know, just listening to, you know, what you've been doing and the work you've been doing.
Mm-hmm.
I thank you on behalf of the Americans that do care for bringing this out into the open and making more of us aware of this problem so that we can, you know, do something about it, you know, participate in whatever way we can. Can you share with people?
There's another important film coming out as well. It's not mine. It's by my friend, Sanjay Rowell, called Food Chain, which doesn't necessarily look specifically at the problem of child labor, but it does look at labor. And he's been shooting this for a while now, and it has, you know, Eric Schlosser, Dolores Huerta from United Farm Workers, Bobby Kennedy Jr., who went down to Immokalee with his mother to participate in the hunger strike, you know, my friends Barry Esterbrook, you know, and Tracy McMillan in it. And it really takes a look at the struggle to gain that penny a pound that the Coalition of Immokalee Workers went through. And it's this beautiful, beautiful look at farm workers. And I can't wait for this film to come out as well.
When is it supposed to come out?
They're editing. We were out last night at a fundraiser, you know, for it. But they're editing right now. And you can see the trailer on Vimeo. And you can go to their website, foodchainfilm.com. But it's this beautiful, beautiful film. And then when Sanjay's done with that, Sanjay's coming on board because I'm developing now a series for broadcast on agriculture, basically on food justice and food security. Because one of the things that I've come to realize, and you've probably known for a very, very long time, is what Wendell Berry said: what we do to the earth, we do to ourselves. And as a result, our agricultural policies are not just make or break at this point. They're, you know, the difference between increased or diminished quality of life. They're, you know, it's the most, I think at this point, it's the most fundamental issue facing us. Not everybody drives a car. You know, not everybody buys a house. Not everybody watches TV. Not even everybody votes. But you know what? I think everybody eats.
Right.
You know, and so, you know, I've been working with...
Wendell Berry also say eating is an agricultural act?
Yeah.
Right?
No, he did. You know, and so, and I'm going to be looking at the question of agriculture from all sides. I was just at the Kellogg Foundation Food and Community Gathering down in Asheville, North Carolina, you know, and we had a lot of people down there who I was speaking to, you know, among them Raj Patel, who's now looking at agricultural markets and talking about the financialization of agricultural markets. So when all of the money went out of the burst bubble of housing, a lot of it now went into commodities. And so you end up with a very, very interesting question downstream, but it's been happening recently, which is food or fuel. Do we feed our population or do we power our vehicles, you know, with alternative sources? I mean, when we look at what was the move to corn in this country and what is all the trouble that we have with corn, You know, it literally was because there was a series of subsidies that so distorted the agricultural markets because we thought ethanol was going to be the savior. And as a result, we began to get all of these genetically modified corns out there, which really do nothing to sustain us. But, you know, they were supposed to power our vehicles.
Right, but even the whole story behind ethanol and what is fed to the American public
right.
is that ethanol was going to be a new resource for fueling our cars, mm-hmm. but it doesn't tell you that you use more oil
right.
to fertilize the corn
right.
to produce the amount of ethanol
well,
that you produce, that it ends up being a net loss.
Right.
So
No, I mean, you know, the fact of the matter is that whenever we talk about agriculture, whenever we talk about anything, we have to talk about it in terms of energy. In that respect. And if you just look at the spreadsheet, the calories that go in versus the calories that we get out, you know, is a very, very asymmetrical thing. Mm-hmm. The point of, and it's sort of like when we look at meat. I don't know what the exact numbers are, but I mean, it's almost like it's like 20 to 1, 50 to 1.
Right. Right.
Where, you know, we have that amount of energy going in, you know, for very little calories coming out to sustain us. So on this is totally it's a totally unsustainable agricultural model. But more importantly, you know, what we look at as well is that, you know, and it's a very real argument that I see when I travel. We may not necessarily see it here, but I travel to Africa a lot, and so the famines that happen there, and then the lack of grains that are available for famine relief. Let's say what happened in Kenya recently, and we've had other famines since then, and we cannot generate, you know, enough nutritional commodities for these people because our agricultural policies are so distorted, and our economic policies are now pricing basic subsistence cereals out of the range of a lot of populations in the developing world. So, you know, when I say we need to look at food, you need to look at food not only as an environmental issue, but you need to look at it as an economic issue, and you need to look at it as an energy issue. You really can break it down into the three E's in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the Hammer-Bosch. Right, how we get pesticides. It's all based on petroleum.
Yeah. Well, that's why I am so passionate about food, because I do feel like it is the link. Like you said, everybody eats, and it is the link that connects us both with our economic realities, our health, and our environment.
Yeah.
And, you know, it touches upon all of them, and so mm-hmm. it is a really amazing thing. I mean, on the front page of the New York Times this week, they were talking about all those thousands of bushels of rice that sat on the side of the road
right.
rotting
mm-hmm.
while 20 miles away, you know, your people are starving and
right.
have no money to feed their families. And and they had to send this rice down to, like, be distilled to
right.
make alcohol or something because mm-hmm. it just was forgotten.
That's just, you know, another stunning example of how profligate and wasteful
yeah.
we are. And ultimately how uncaring, you know, when so many go hungry, even in this country.
Even in this country. I know, like at Hunts Point Market,
right.
trying to get the produce that is not going to be sold, that mm-hmm. is left over, trying to get them to donate that to mm-hmm. food pantries, they'd rather throw it out.
Right.
You know, they'd rather throw it out than give it away for free
well,
to those that need it. And
yeah.
it makes no sense to me.
I mean, you know, we forget that Hunts Point is the largest food distribution point in mm-hmm. the United States of America. And yet at least 4 of the top 10 food deserts, you know, exist within like a 3-mile radius of it. All of that outlying region of all the people that live around Hunts Point live in a certified food desert. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, I've been working on this new series. One of the people I've been working with is this remarkable man called Steve Ritz, who runs Green.
Steve.
Yeah.
He's going to be on the show
yeah.
in a few weeks.
Yeah. You know, Steve's become a very, very good friend. And he runs this wonderful program called Green Bronx Machine,
mm-hmm.
where he takes kids that everyone else has given up on, and he literally gets them planting vertical walls. And what he's
excited about learning.
Yeah, excited about learning. He's, you know, as he said, he's teaching them both hard and soft skills. You know, and these kids are coming out with skills that generate a great amount of income, with a passion for work, but also with a passion for nutrition and a passion that they can reinvest in their own communities. And so this, to my mind, is the type of literacy we need in schools today. We need nutritional literacy.
Absolutely. I love the work that he's doing, and it is so important. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have kids that come out to my place from the River Fund food pantry just to spend a day working in the garden, harvesting some food, bringing it in, come into the kitchen, let's cook lunch together, and just having a day of normalcy, you know, where they can get their hands in the soil and see how the food's grown and know that it's possible.
Yeah. And Steve's also sort of... closing the loop on the dodgy issue of labor, because now Steve is beginning to supply a lot of these restaurants, and because Steve is so pro-skill, pro-kid, you know, as a result, you become pro-labor. So, you know, for the first time, many of these restaurants are actually involved in a righteous cycle of agriculture. You know, they're taking the poor, the disenfranchised, you know, who are being empowered by Steve, and then further empowerment and decent wages are being paid for their produce. So finally, you know, Steve is creating this very, very healthy closed nutritional cycle for his kids in areas that you know, haven't seen a decent calorie in years.
Mm-hmm. It's very exciting.
Yeah.
It's very exciting. He was out at the Small Farm Summit on Long Island in April, and yeah, his work, I saw his TEDx.
Yeah.
If anyone out there has not seen the TEDx with Steve Ritz, it's pretty great.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Pretty great. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in a recent poll, I'd say 90% of Americans said they'd be willing to pay more for their food in order to treat the farm workers more fairly and to end this cycle of poverty. You know, and yet, like you said, the Obama administration's not responding to what people are saying. So what can people do? Where can you suggest people go to get involved if this is an issue that's passionate for them or that they feel passion for? Mm-hmm. What can people do?
Write to your congresspeople. I always begin with that. And don't email them. Write them a hard letter. You know, I would just sort of say, find out where your representatives are in Washington. Send a letter to their branch office, send a letter to their D.C. office and say, look, I support the CARE bill, you know, and, you know, we're going through this with GMOs. I support, you know, in other words, whatever it is that is important to you where your existence is concerned, because that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about, you know, the corporal health.
And a lot of this is addressed on the Food and Farm Bill. Is child labor at all addressed on the Food and Farm Bill?
No, it's been, you know, it's off the table. And as a matter of fact, this Farm Bill resembles all previous Farm Bills in that, you know, it's not that good. And
it's amazing. I mean, there is such a movement now, such a grassroots movement. I don't know if you saw Will Allen last night on the Stephen Colbert
No, I didn't.
Show. He was on talking about his new book, The Good Food Revolution. But there is a good food revolution happening. There are people caring about this, and the sustainable agriculture is really in the forefront. Mm-hmm. And it is ridiculous that that this is not being picked up by our congressmen, the people that we've elected to represent us, and they're not. They're just representing the, you know, small amount of farmers that actually receive the subsidies. I mean, the majority of small family farmers that we're talking about, they don't even receive any of those subsidies. Right. Most of the people that receive the subsidies, actually the most, this shocked me, the most popular zip codes for the people that are receiving subsidies, it's the Upper East Side of New York City.
Right.
You know, they don't even live on the farm. They have nothing to do with their farms. You know, they just, they might be the landowner, and then the farm runs on their own, and they get the subsidies, and they're in New York.
Right. And the problem also is that the food stamps, the SNAP programs, and, you know, and all the supplemental nutritional programs that, you know, basically are being cut.
Right.
You know, the young farmers, which should be expanded, you know, as we look for, you know, alternative methods of agriculture. We want to encourage, you know, young farm workers, because right now the average age of a farmer in the States is
over 60.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Right.
So, you know, you would think that this is where they would actually be putting their money, but, you know, the disconnect is really extraordinary. On the other hand, though, I have to say that, you know, maybe this is a revolution that needs to happen, you know, under its own steam. You know, in some ways, maybe this is better off without government interference. But, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, since government does appear to be in such a state of deadlock and decline at this point that, you know, I'm just, you know, find your solutions locally, because that is where we are going to have to go in the big picture eventually.
Well, one thing I didn't mention, and I don't know if you're aware of, I'm sure you are, every Saturday at Bryan Park at 12 mm-hmm. o'clock, there's a civil disobedience training,
right.
you know, for the 99% mm-hmm. movement. And, you know, I did my first one last summer down in Washington. It was the most empowering thing I've done, you know, mm-hmm. stepping up to, you know, boycott and make aware the issue revolving around the Keystone Pipeline.
Right.
And that just felt great to be with people taking action. And so, you know, we all have to get mad. We all have to get really pissed off.
I think we all have to get mad. And we also, you know, we're all going to have to put our thinking caps on. You know, as my friend Chris Martinson says, you know, the next 20 years are not going to look like the last 20 years. You know, we no longer can afford, you know, the 2,500-mile Caesar salad. We talked about calories earlier. We talked about petroleum. Well, you know, the point of fact is we're running out of these types of disposable energy.
Uh-huh.
So the point of fact is we are literally going to have to be pioneers of a new, sustainable, and local agricultural model that can support communities throughout the country individually. We're going to have to learn to live in our bioregions again.
Right, right. And to me, that's really exciting.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I think there's going to be a lot of transformation. It's not going to always be easy, but change isn't always easy.
No.
But I'm looking forward to it.
Well, I think, you know, we both see the challenge. You know, you and I are both out in our gardens. You know, I mean, Steve Ritz came out last weekend, and we planted these wonderful heirloom stripies. And, you know, we got manure from the zoo, from the elephant cage, which is, like, really powerful, great stuff. So, you know, I think it's reconnecting ourselves.
Yeah.
To the things that nurture and feed us can only be good.
Right. And for many of us, I know for myself, it's really learning for the first time, because I didn't grow up connected to my earth, you know, my soil. You know, I didn't grow food when I was younger.
Yeah. We're connecting back to the traditions.
Anyway, real quick before we go off air, how would people find out about the work you're doing? Where would they get in touch?
They can go to my website, urobertoromano.com. They can also learn about The Harvest at theharvestfilm.com as well. You can Google The Dark Side of Chocolate, and we've made Mickey Mastrati, my co-director on that, and I have made that film now public over the internet, so anybody can watch it.
Oh, great, great.
So
it's
those
important
are three
film.
Places you can go see
important
it.
Important film. Everybody out there, it's been great spending this last hour with you, and I look forward to being with you again next week. Hope you can join us tonight at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington, and have a great rest of the week.